Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Hello, and welcome to The Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is one of our favorite people in the world and also one of the best writers about film and television in the game. She's a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. Her previous bylines include Pajiba, RogerEbert.com, The LA Times, The AV Club, Polygon, The Playlist, Fox Digital, GQ, Inverse, and hey, Crooked Marquee. I know that site. Please welcome Roxana Haddadi. Hi, Roxana.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much. Ugh, the bio always makes me like very uncomfortable, but I appreciate it regardless.
It's like it's somebody else being your hype man. Like if I had like a podcast host, like if Blake Howard would come to every like social gathering with me and like introduce me to the room before I came in, I feel like mm-hmm. I would be much more comfortable in social situations. That's
absolutely
just me.
I also just want Blake to live in this country. Like, I understand.
That would help. That'd be easier.
You know, Australia, whatever.
Right.
But just, like, come Australia. To the U.S.
Whatever.
There's nothing wrong with what's going on in our country.
No. Why would you not want to live in this country in 2025? Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. This is the first episode we're recording of the new show. Similarly, yes. A little bit of trivia for listeners who may not know. You were the guest on the very first episode we ever recorded of A Very Good Year, our previous show. So now you're just our good luck charm. Whenever we launch a new show because the previous one has turned out to be more work than we anticipated, you will always be the first person we ask to come on. So thank you for doing that.
Of course. Yes, it is my pleasure. That was such a blast to do. So I'm excited for this one too.
Yay. Well, before we get to the matter at hand, I wanted to tell you how much I love this. We'll link to it in the show notes. This piece you just wrote about Baby Girl. I know we have commiserated before about the relative sexlessness of the current cinema.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It feels like a lot of people saw and were excited about this and Nosferatu, which both came out on the same day and was also mm-hmm. a pretty horny movie. My question is, do you think, I always want there to be a trend towards something that I'm in favor of. Do you think we might be seeing turning of the tides here in terms of sex in cinema, you know, in the latter half of the 2020s?
I mean, I would love that. I fear that is not the future that we are facing down in like this country right now. But I don't know, because I think people enjoyed both of those movies and were surprised by both of those movies. And mm-hmm. I also think that like the sex in Baby Girl is relatively tame. So I'm both like very excited that we got it, and also mm-hmm. like this wasn't that serious. Like this wasn't that big of a deal. So I don't know. I think maybe we will get more potential like women forward sex movies, maybe. But I also think Baby Girl has like actually a very conservative core that I anticipate that being more of the kind of thing that we're gonna get. Ultimately, I just want more Harris Dickinson. I don't know what form that will come in.
Sure. I mean, I think that's understandable.
That's sort of what I want. Yeah, I want more opportunities to realize that this man has a tattoo of a cherub wearing a balaclava holding a machine gun. That's the 2025 that I want. Yeah.
I'm with you on that. I'd like to point out, by the way, to any podcast listeners, anyone who's listening on your podcatcher, we do now have a YouTube version. We're recording video. We will cut video. And I just want to point out what you might be missing if you're only listening, which is that right over my shoulder here, my cat is bathing itself. This, friends, this is the good shit you only get on the YouTube version.
This is the content. That's the content.
This is the content. Yeah. Like, you know, one could, you know, maybe we'll splice in the clip of Harris dancing to Father Figure, but I can't promise that, but I can promise you this, and who knows, maybe I'll play Father Figure for the cat later and we'll get that going.
I think that makes sense. I also was curious if you think the cat heard us talking about Baby Girl and the saucers of milk within the movie and was like, maybe I can get a saucer of milk out of this. Like, who can say?
It is a milk heavy movie. Fluffy over here is a boy, but I'm going to go ahead and call him a good girl anyway.
Fluffy? Oh, wow.
So, Roxanna, to the matter at hand, what film from Guide for the Film Fanatic did you select to discuss today?
The Godfather Part 2.
And that is our trailer cue. You know it's a serious movie because they start with bells in the trailer.
That is serious.
The history of two generations of crime.
Yep.
The drama of absolute power and the men who violate it.
Like, have you ever seen this trailer before? As many times you've seen the movie? Why would you watch the trailer? It just seems insane to me that there even is a trailer. Obviously there's a trailer. But
they did want to show people things before it came out, yes.
Both had seen the ones they loved most cut down before their eyes.
Two people.
Both had killed as an act of vengeance.
I mean, I think it probably was important to prepare people for the dual storytelling happening here.
I could see that.
You don't want to blindside anybody with that in the theater.
Is it true that in the year 1950, you devised the murder...
Do we see Roger Corman in the trailer? Is the shot wide enough for Roger Corman in the background at the Nah. That
was it's all faces.
That's how you sell the movie, is Roger Corman's in it.
I don't feel I have to wipe everybody out, Tom. Just my enemies.
It's a good cold line.
It's such a good line.
It really is. I feel the same, frankly. I mean, I don't think that's sociopathic. I'm with Michael on that one.
No. I really don't think he did anything wrong.
The Godfather.
And his heir. Both were men of ice, and both were targets.
I mean, this VO is like pure exploitation movie.
It is. You really don't expect. I do. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola came out of the Corman School, man. They knew how to sell a movie.
But that's not how this movie has been talked about any time since we've been paying attention to how movies get talked about. You know what I mean? That's all.
Right. Yeah.
It is revolution in Havana.
A lot of good parties in Godfather 2. We'll talk about that.
This trailer is really, like, giving away more than I would have thought.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a thing, as we're playing these full trailers. Yeah, spoiler culture did not exist pre, like, 2001.
It is murder. And it is betrayal.
It is murder and it is betrayal. I would agree with those.
That's true. That's accurate.
I don't know that we need to show the spouse abuse in the trailer. I don't know what that's necessary.
People were like, you know what? I'm split on this movie, but if that's in here.
If that's in there, I'm in.
If someone hits Diane Keaton, I'm in.
I'm not a big spouse abuse, you know, movie guy. I'm not sure how else to say it.
Wow. You heard it here first, gang. Mike taking a stand.
He can, like, shoot everybody in the face, but, like, upset when he, like, smacks Kay real quick.
You're right.
Like,
you're right.
I don't want that to sound like I'm standing up for smacking your wife or anything. But
no.
Sure.
But don't you feel like this is sort of, I was going to say something that a lot of people would be mad about, so I'm not going to say it. Let me just Okay. Back off from that.
Put a pin in it. We'll put a pin in it. Yeah. Let's do for anyone who hasn't seen Godfather 2, who's listening to the show, and I can't imagine why you would frankly have done either of those things. But here's our quick summary. In Francis Ford Coppola's first follow-up to his 1972 box office champ and Academy Award winner, he tells two parallel intermingling stories, one a prequel and one a sequel, which is very clever. As with the first film, Coppola directs and co-writes the screenplay with the novelist Mario Puzo. He also produces, taking over for Robert Evans and Al Ruddy. That's right, folks. Somehow, right. He managed to make the movie without the invaluable assistance of Al the Offer Ruddy. Also returning from the first film are Diane Keaton, Talia Shire, Morgana King, and Richard Bright, as well as James Caan and Abe Vigoda in the epilogue. New additions include Michael V. Gazzo, G.D. Spradlin, Bruno Kirby, Danny Aiello, Harry Dean Stanton, Dominic Chianese, a.k.a. Junior Soprano, and our old pal, Joe Spinell. All right.
Fuck yeah, Joe Spinell. Movie Hell one, yeah. Show one, Joe Spinell. It was Joe a must. Spinell. It had. It was a must.
There was the conversation about just doing the Joe Spinell cast was not lengthy, but it was entertaining. Mike, what does our friend Mr. Danny Perry say about The Godfather Part 2 in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
We can't start this show by reading this sure review. You can. Are you out of your
yes,
mind?
We can. Of course
this
you can.
This guy's crazy.
I mean,
this review is incredible. All right.
The wonderful duality of our show's namesake.
Here we go. Director Francis Ford Coppola and his co-writer Mario Puzo cut back and forth between the late 50s when Michael Corleone Al Pacino, who now lives in Nevada, strengthens his father's family's business, he puts in quotes, at the expense of his becoming an isolated tyrant and destroying the remnants of his family, and the late 1890s, early 1900s, when his father Vito came to New York as a boy, and as a young man, Robert De Niro grew into the protector and godfather of the poor Italians in his neighborhood and started a personal family and large extended family. That is a fucking sentence, all you writers out there.
That's
boy,
one sentence.
That guy used every form of punctuation in the English language at least twice. Okay. Yep.
I love that. Wow. Okay.
We get the impression Vito would not have been infatuated with his son. Coppola doesn't have De Niro or Pacino do much acting, limiting them to little snippets of dialogue and many moments when they react with quiet, calm voices to the more emotional and demonstrative peripheral characters around them. De Niro gets on by presence alone. His charming smile, his quizzical look, his physical grace. But Pacino is a brooding bore. His character does not develop logically from the person he played in the original, but is a caricature of a crime boss. I mean, what are we doing here? Are
yeah,
we really?
That feels... Wow.
This is the namesake of our show.
Here we go.
This is insanity.
Here we go. Come on. Come on.
Jason,
keep it going.
I feel like you pulled me into a trap. I feel like you tricked me.
I have not.
All these major scenes seem unreal, calculated for audience response. Phoniest of all is his breakup scene with wife Diane Keaton, which looks over rehearsed like a scene for an acting class.
Oh my God.
In fact, several of the major scenes in the contemporary section come across as mere duplications of real life drama we've seen on television. The Jack Ruby kills Oswald assassination, the Senate crime hearings. The scene in which the senator, G.D. Spradlin, is found in a brothel with a hooker he brutally killed is similar to numerous sequences in exploitation films of the era and is included for no reason other than sensationalism. The only moments that come across as real are when the crime bosses and legitimate businessmen gather in Batista's Cuba to decide how to divide up the American pie. It's commendable that Coppola tried to broaden his scope and be more political. And when a Jewish crime boss, a terrific, subdued debut performance by legendary acting teacher Lee Strasberg, raises rather than lowers the volume on a televised football game while talking over important crime business with Michael. That one moment, boop, that's the, I mean, it's a good moment, but like, that's the only good thing in the whole fucking movie? This guy, this is wild. Okay, okay. We're almost done here. critically acclaimed film walked away with several Oscars, including those for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Score by Nino Rota. Surprisingly, Gordon Willis, whose cinematography is even better than in the original, wasn't even nominated. Bong, Danny Perry out.
That is his capsule. Now, we're not gonna dwell on this. We're not gonna spend a bunch of time interrogating Mr. Perry.
I'm scandalized.
Sure. I know.
Michael is gonna interrogate it later on his own.
I mean, what I think is important and why I'm actually glad that we landed on a review like this for the first show out of the gate is, number one, the book is The Organizing Principle. It's a great checklist of movies. He doesn't necessarily love all of them, obviously. We don't necessarily agree with everything he says about all of them, obviously. But the book is a terrific compendium of movies with a lot of great movies to talk about. And that, I think, is what's great.
And some strong shit there. I mean, he's got some opinions to work with. I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah. Agree with him or not, he's giving you something to think about.
Absolutely. They're distinct opinions. Like, I don't agree with any of them, but they're at least like things.
Yeah,
he is honing
and
in
that's
on. Yeah.
I mean, and that's what's that I think is like hopefully something we're able to achieve on the show is that like we're gonna have a conversation even if we don't all agree about all the same stuff. And so that there we go. Warning shot. Okay, so we've put that out. That's on the table. Okay, let's now each get a little personal. Obviously, starting with you, Roxana, what is your personal history with the series, but then specifically with Godfather 2, and why was that the title that jumped out at you from this 1600 plus film list as what you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I have talked about this at length, like on social media, and I think maybe on other podcasts as well. But like the Godfather movies were very much like our family sort of movies. Mm. Like we watched Godfather and Godfather Part 2 around the holidays. They were like our Christmas pricks. It was like I would always call it Kung Pao and Corleone's because that was like what we did for the holidays.
That's a good ass tradition right there.
Yeah. And my dad was a big movie fan when I was young, and he shaped so much of my taste, and he just really loved these, and I think in particular loved Part 2 because we get the time in the old country and so much of that sort of like Sicilian blood feud, funeral, group mourning sort of thing, I think was very familiar to him from like growing up in a small village in Iran. And I think all of that felt like, oh, I see some aspect of like my old country traditions in this. Obviously, like Vito coming to this country, trying to find his place. I think all of that stuff really spoke to him. And for me, I don't know. I loved hearing the review because I was like, wait, isn't what he's saying, isn't acting, isn't that acting? Like, aren't the things you is saying are not the thing? Isn't that the thing? I love how like sort of ugly and cynical this movie is, while also being like a very beautiful portrait of how trying to like maintain certain traditions and certain customs will inevitably be corrupted just by like the nature of what America is. I love all of that stuff. I mean, it blows my mind to say like De Niro is just getting by on vibes because like it's De Niro. De Niro in this movie. I don't know. You know, like, he's so vulnerable and beautiful and forceful and, I don't know, just like a coiled wire. So, yeah, it's very much a part of me, this and Godfather, just like a part of what made me fall in love with movies and with the ritual of movies and sitting on the couch with my dad and just all of that stuff. So, like, it's very close to me. And in scrolling through the book, I think I just realized that I hadn't talked about two. Like, I think I've talked about the first one before, but I don't think I've really talked about two and just how audacious it feels in form and just how much bigger it goes. Like, I do like that the review praised the Cuba scenes, because that's one of my favorite things, is like, we're going to go to this other country that America really fucked up. Right. We're going to decide how we're also going to fuck things up. I love the echo of that. But yeah, so that's all, you know, that's all sort of my, I love it. I love whatever. Toxic men. I don't know. How do people talk about this movie in 2025?
I mean, definitely, yes. We all love toxic men these days.
We do. We really do. Yeah.
It's so America. Mike, what mm-hmm. is your personal history with Godfather 2?
I have no memory of seeing it.
It's just always existed.
Existed. And I sort of remember, though, there was this time, Jason, you're old enough to remember, Roxanna, I don't know if you are, but there was a time when, like, Citizen Kane became the best movie, and it was mm-hmm. sort of like, instead of Godfather 2, was just sort of like mm-hmm. a given. It just sort of seemed like, I don't know, it was like nobody ever really said that, but it just sort of seemed like it was a given. Like, no, it's not actually that. It's this older thing. And I don't know if anybody else felt that way, but that was just sort of how I had always read the room, was like, that was the best movie. And I don't remember seeing it for the first time or anything. I don't remember sort of, I just feel like I've always seen it. It's just always been around mm-hmm. since before I could understand what the fuck it was. I don't think my parents particularly like it, but I have seen my dad watching it 10 times since I've like moved back into his orbit. Yeah. You know what I mean? So obviously, you know, he didn't see it for the first time recently. I didn't have to tell him about it. You know, the thing that has always sort of been fascinating, and this is, I'm going to tell an extremely brief story and you'll understand why. One time I was cleaning my apartment and I was listening to Bitch Get In My Car by 50 Cent. And I was really feeling that song. I was really enjoying it. And I'm not sure why. It's a good song. But, you know, I don't know why that day I was really feeling it. And my girlfriend at the time said, can you explain something to me? And I said, what? And she said, what exactly do you relate to in this song? And I had no answer. I had nothing. A totally valid question. Yeah. And wow. I haven't talked to her in years, but obviously she fucked me up with that one. You know, it has stuck. And that's the thing about this movie that has always sort of been present for me that I've never really been able to explain, is like, why do all of us like this movie so much? Like, there's literally mm-hmm. nothing relatable about it. Like, if you talk about even the immigrant experience, like, that's definitely like, I can understand how that would be relatable to people, but that immigrant the movie's mostly about killing people and stealing rugs and shit. Like, most people didn't really do that kind of stuff, even though they had to do some scrappy shit to survive. Right. So like, sure. That's the thing to me, is like, to this day, I don't understand why this movie feels so personal and so intimately mm-hmm. relatable, but it does. And that's part of why I think of the second one actually as even better than the first one. The first one is a more like crackerjack, like, you know, bang, 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 like, holy shit, this is a 70s movie, utterly badass, peak of its form. But what makes the second one better is that in some way it feels like a movie about my fucking grandfather or something. And I met both of my grandfathers. They were not like that. They came from fire and brimstone, like, bullshit white people right. preacher types. Like, that was not their experience, right? But somehow it feels like a movie. It feels like my movie, and everybody feels that way. I still can't explain it. I still feel it.
Roxanna, is Godfather 2 superior to Godfather 1?
I say yes, because I think it's doing more. I think it's saying more. I think Godfather 1 is very much a story of like morality and family, and I think 2 is very much about like the cycles of America and how impossible it is to get clean, and that always sort of like appeals to me. So I think it's broader thematically. I think the performances are, I don't know, more weighted by time. Like, I rewatched yesterday and I rewatched today. And I love Duvall in this so much because Duvall is just like a broken, exhausted man, right? And like, I love that sense of even within the movie, I think the characters feel like, I can't believe we're still doing this. Like, we're still caught in this. And I just,
The arguments between him and Michael don't feel anything like the arguments between Michael and Sonny in the first one.
Not
like
at all.
Even though they are that sort of in that same sort of vein, conceptually speaking, like on paper.
Yeah.
But when he challenges Michael, I mean, that's some of the like the strongest, you know, emotional and everything about that is just like, whoa. But it's like silent and you can barely see it. I mean, how the fuck is that even possible?
Like, no, the silence is so true. This movie is so quiet. Like, just the long scenes of, like, Michael sitting in his Nevada office. Like, there's just a sense of, it's not stillness necessarily, but, like, a sense of stasis, I think, permeates this movie in a really fascinating way. And then contrasted with, like, Vito's New York, right?
Yeah,
which is, like, bustling and energetic. And people are just, like, earning a living. It's a very different idea of like what it is to be a person in this country. I think
that might be part of the answer too, is like, you know, Dolly Parton can sell out soccer stadiums in Nigeria. Like, how does that make sense? It makes sense because people, the stories that are being told about moving to the city and about missing that sort of, like you're talking about, the warmth of you know, the New York stuff, missing that, remembering that from our childhood. And this movie has a profound sense of being lonely in a crowd that I think is something else that, like, you know, we either experience or we fear experiencing. One way or another, we all sort of, you know, seeing that played out in this thing is cathartic in a way. And the fact that it really does, like, ultimately it is kind of his fault. I mean, I know he keeps saying it's not, but it ultimately is kind of his fault. And I think that there's a way that we watch movies where bad things happen to people. And there is a sort of, you know, like, whatever, women in true crime is sort of like, that hasn't happened to me. Like, I have made better choices, something that, and it's unspoken. We're not sitting there telling ourselves I'm a better person than Michael Corleone, and so my family's not going to fall apart. But I really think there's some in our lizard brain, there's some part of that that's happening with this movie. And it's just so cleanly, purely, beautifully, and properly represented. But also the quietness gives us time to feel it on our own. And to interpret it on our own and to relate to it in our own ways, the quietness of it. I would never sell out my family like Fredo. Like, that sucks that he got fucking, you know, had to go fishing. But like, I would never do that. So that's not going to happen to me.
Yeah. Right? You walk away from Godfather Part Two being like, Fredo, what an idiot.
I would simply not sell out my family.
I'm simply built different. That's what Mike is saying. I'm built different.
Men will kill their brother on a fishing boat rather than go to therapy. Okay, so I'm not trying to be the fly in the ointment here. Not trying to be Mr. Perry's avatar here, but I will say that and Mike and I have had this conversation. You see him leaning back like ready for my bullshit. We've had, because we've been having this conversation for, you know, 35 years. I love Godfather 2. I don't want to come off like the guy who doesn't like Godfather 2. I'm a man of impeccable taste.
I'll be honest. A man who says this makes me think he's going to say, I don't really like Godfather 2.
But.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I do believe Godfather 2 to be sort of indisputably inferior to Godfather 1 in my personal, obviously not indisputably, because we're going to dispute about it a little bit, but my feeling, and I will say this too, I will own this. This is an opinion that may very, very well have been disproportionately colored by a review that we will read an excerpt from a little later in the show. As a movie crazy tween slash teen, I not only owned, in fact, I can show you the exact edition right fucking here. I not only owned every year's Roger Ebert movie Home Companion, but like read this shit so much that like there were passages of reviews that I had like committed to memory. Sometimes I will be writing a review now and I'll be like, I'll reread and I'll be like, no, I got to rephrase that because I just completely bit that from like a 1992 Roger Ebert review. Mm-hmm. And in his original 1974 review of Godfather 2, Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars.
Mm-hmm.
And the summation of which I will paraphrase now and we'll read a little later is that basically he likes the movie, he likes the flashbacks, and he thinks that put together, it makes the movie feel too messy. That it becomes, I don't even want to spoil it because it's such a good turn of phrase, but the idea that, and I subscribe to this, but I don't know how much of this is my boy Roger putting this in my brain before I saw the movie, which I'll tell you about.
You, yes, or is this him? Yeah,
could be all.
You know
all
why? Owned. That's why you shouldn't read. I think
this is the danger
for a living. Yeah,
other people have opinions.
Yeah,
but I feel that The Godfather Part One is a perfectly stitched. I'm going to steal an analogy you've used before, Mike. It's a perfectly stitched Italian suit. Every single seam is flawless. The material it doesn't wrinkle. It feels good against your skin. It's perfect. It is a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm.
It is a flawless piece of cinematic art. It is my favorite film of all time. When people ask me that lame ass question, that's the answer I give. That's the lame ass predictable answer I give.
It's Godfather also my answer. Two, so yeah.
The Godfather Part Two. It's a little lumpy. There's like, this sleeve is a little bit longer than that one. It's a little tight around the collar. It's like, it's a good suit. It's just, it doesn't feel quite right on me.
Do you think the problem is the suit or do you think the problem is the body?
Look, it could go either way. It could go either way. But let me say this, that in revisiting for the show, and I'll always take an excuse to, like, I was thrilled when you put it out there. It's like, oh, great. I have an excuse to block off 3.5 hours and think about the Corleones. The flaws that have always perturbed me about it are still very clear to me. Mm-hmm. And some of which were in Coppola's control and some of which were not. I think the primary problem with Godfather 2 is not actually, as Ebert said, the dual structure. Like, I think that's actually, I think that's a masterstroke, and especially as the more the film goes on, the way that those become the sort of what's happening in the fade betweens become counterpoints to each other is fucking brilliant. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have always been bothered by the Clemenza switch up. If you don't know the backstory, you know, Richard Castellano played the loyal Lieutenant Clemenza in Godfather 1. He's terrific in it. Has some of my best scenes, some of my favorite scenes in it are Clemenza scenes. And when they wrote clearly the Clemenza role, like a better role, this incredible role in the sequel. And when they went to him to ask, you know, to make the offer that everyone else accepted, he decided this is my moment to do a power play and made a series of, and depending on who you read, but unreasonable demands for what it would take to get him back, the kind of control he would want over his character and over his scenes and the kind of money he wanted and so forth and so on. And basically he brought all this to Coppola and Coppola said, fuck you. And rewrote the character into this new guy that we're introduced to, Frankie Pentagli. you know, who's also been a loyal lieutenant for this entire time, but
this
you
whole
know.
Time. And, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I understand why the change had to be made. I understand. But it is for me a flaw that I am always aware of every time I watch the movie. And for you non-YouTuber, Mike is shaking his head with, it's not even furiously, it's like, oh, you poor thing, you poor kid.
You are talking some flat earth shit right now, bro. I don't even know who you are. Sorry, go ahead.
But what I don't understand is, like, was it, okay, I want to know when the flaw became apparent to you relative to when you knew that backstory.
I don't know. I'm certainly not on first viewing, but because the first time I saw this movie, I was 15 years old. I didn't know any of the production history type stuff.
Reaction was like, who's this guy?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Didn't feel right. Didn't feel right to me.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I feel like that's the obvious argument. Yes. Yeah. But like, isn't like the obvious argument just like, It's a big crime family.
He was locked up. Now he's home.
Then you know what they should have done?
Done? Sold.
Bruno Kirby should have played the young Frank Pentangeli instead of the young Clemenza. Like, why are you telling me all this fucking backstory about Clemenza when he's not in this movie anymore? Why not? I mean, if you're gonna do the manual typewriter equivalent of find replace for old Clemenza, why not do it for young Clemenza? I've taken up way too much time with this very, I'm sure, minor in the scheme of things thing.
I mean, no, but like, I get it. I think for me, it just works for me because I think all of these, like, the family is too big. It's too unwieldy at this point. Like, mm-hmm. Michael doesn't have the control that he thinks that he has. Like, I think it feeds that aspect of the film for me. But like, we know that Clemenza was important. So like, I don't mind that we get young Clemenza. I reject it.
That's fine. I'll accept your rejection. I'm not going to the mat for this thing. Talk to me about young Robert De Niro in this movie. Talk to me about what he's doing in this movie, Roxana.
Aside of potentially being like the hottest man who has ever lived, which really strong case for that in this film.
Where do you come to this is an occasional social media pop quiz.
I know. Who
young Pacino
hotter?
Or young De Niro, who was hotter? Where do you land on that divide?
I land on young De Niro, and I'm going to reveal an aspect of myself that, as I said, could make me toxic.
Okay.
But for me, an important question is, do I think that this man could kill someone else to defend me?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I think that young Robert De Niro really could have done that.
Sure.
So that is the appeal for me. Like, what if we're on a hike and there's like a mountain lion and it attacks me? Like, I think young Robert De Niro could have killed the mountain lion.
Right. Michael needs like daddy's boys to set up a scenario, tape the thing behind the thing, make a whole plan, hire a getaway driver. Yeah, right. He needs like a crew. De Niro just handle business and like come home, not even tell you it's done, and just sit down with a kid and eat spaghetti, and you'll just never hear from that motherfucker again. Yeah, I think you're right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that so much. But both achingly beautiful. I just think that like De Niro exuded like a more natural capacity for violence that unfortunately I find attractive. So yeah, I'm going to go with De Niro in this argument. But to go back to like the little excerpt of the review that we read, it's so fascinating to me that like, what did it say that De Niro is just sort of like posturing? Like Vito, we learn, is like a quiet interior internal character who grew up essentially like forcibly mute because of all of like this horrible like generational trauma that happened to him. So like, I think what De Niro does so well, and what I think it mirrors in what Brando did, is like he's always watching, right? There is a real sense of like absorbing, I think, that De Niro gives young Vito when he is like walking the streets that we were talking about that feel so warm and so chaotic and so alive. I think he's just like taking it all in. And I also love, like, Mike, to your point of just like murdering the Black Hand guy and calmly coming home. There's nothing about that that feels flat to me. It feels like it is like an expression of control and like demarcated identities that we would see to such an extreme with Michael like later in his life. So I think for me, there's the there's the very superficial, like, oh, they really cast a very, very attractive man to do this. And more just like what De Niro was in that era of his career, which is someone who really could convey like a very simmering background with very little like dialogue or physicality. It's just all in the face. And so I just love watching it to watch him like watch his kids and look at the big pile of guns that Clemenza throws through the window. Like, you completely understand that moment for him is a choice, and you're watching him make that choice. So yeah,
watching Robert De Niro think on screen is like one of the real pleasures of this era.
You can do a sort of counterfactual too of like, you know, okay, so then let's put a more expressive actor in the role. Like, let's make Jack Nicholson young Vito. Let's make fucking, you know, right? Yeah. I mean, like, let's think about Gene Hackman as young Vito. Like, fuck no, dude. And Hackman's great in everything he's in that era. But he was smart enough to know what he could play and what he couldn't.
Right.
You know, sort of what he's best at and what he isn't. And you think about the counterfactuals, even just swap De Niro and Pacino in this movie, who are both brilliant. Absolutely not. And that might just be because I'm sort of used to it, but I don't think so. I think I'm sort of smart enough to think through a counterfactual, and nobody else. I mean, the way he's doing it is, it's also like part of what's so brilliant about it and what makes it sort of more than the sum of it part of its parts is, like, you know, De Niro in part two is setting up Vito in part one, where when he speaks, people listen because he doesn't fucking talk that much. And that's one of those things where, like, as you pointed out, it's both a prequel and a sequel at the same time. It is actually setting up a bunch of stuff from the first movie in a way that you don't ever see done artfully or craftily in that way.
Right.
You know,
right. That is the last question I'd like to pose before we get to the release, is that, all of that said, as brilliant as the origin stuff is, do we have Godfather 2 to blame for our current malaise of endless bullshit origin stories and Easter eggs and we're gonna find out where that's comic book's fault.
They're not shooting that high. That's comic book's fault.
Jason literally said, do we have to blame Godfather 2 for Han Solo's last name?
Solo I mean, they both, that's a scene at, you know, an immigration center. I'm just saying, the influence is there if you want to see. Friend of the show, Bradford Young, very Willis inspired. Look, I'm not pointing any fingers. All I'm doing is asking questions. Let's talk a little bit.
I think that if that's what they were intending to do, more power to them. It should have been in a better fucking movie. Okay.
There we go. I'm gonna say about that. There we have it. Friends, let's talk about the release and reception of our movie, Godfather Part II, which opened in New York City on December 12th, 1974. Also in New York theaters on that opening day, Fellini's Amacord, Airport 1975, Sidney Lumet's Murder on the Orient Express, John Cassavetes' A Woman Under the Influence, Stone Cold Masterpiece, Lenny, The Front Page, Death Wish, The Gambler, That's Entertainment, Harry and Tonto, Flesh Gordon, and a Mike Hull favorite, The Night Porter. Also, at the Love, Cinemart, and Avon 7 theaters in New York, you could have seen on that same day a double feature of Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones that was advertised in the Times under the tagline, 72,370 couples have seen this show. I don't know where they got those numbers from, but that was Porto chic, baby. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day, December 12th, 1974?
Thursday, December 12th, 1974, according to the New York Times, Jimmy Carter announced his candidacy for president.
Oh, how'd that go? Yeah,
that would actually,
timely as shit. Yeah,
that would actually end up, you know, having real ramifications. New York City was an absolute fucking disaster, and they were firing people. They fired 3,725 people, including 1,100 people who worked in the schools. 900, it says in uniform, so I don't know if that's cops, if that's robbers. Oh, sorry, those are the same thing. I don't know if that's cops, if that's firemen. I'm not, I mean, you've seen Serpico. Come on, it's 1974.
Yeah, it's true.
It is
true.
But they fired a bunch of people, and they were apparently forcing 2,700 other people to retire. So it was a tough time to live in New York generally.
Yeah, little bit of fiscal malaise. There's a whole other podcast about that.
There was a whole Top of the Fold front page article about a guy nobody's ever heard of who was sent to be the envoy to India. I'm shocked, frankly, that was terrible news judgment, actually, to put that Top of the Fold, even for just a random Thursday. And Hurricane Carter was denied a new trial. That was happening at the time as well. And there's a movie about that if you'd like to know more about it.
In all fairness, Bob hadn't written the song yet, so maybe people just ain't know yet.
But, you know, it was on the front page of the Times. I mean, it was one of those things where, like, you know, somebody was paying attention. But, like, I mean, you got to think about 1974. Like, the people who are, like, the judges in 1974, like, they all got shot by Nazis. They're still angry. There's not.
Yeah.
You know, right? They're still using all kinds of words that we wouldn't use today, like, in their professional life. I mean, you got to think, you know, those things move slowly. And finally, the South Boston schools were shut down in clashes over a stabbing. If we've listened to our 1974 Kevin Cruz episode, we talked a little bit about the process of integrating schools in Boston in 1974.
Right. Wasn't going well.
And how that was.
Yeah.
Yeah. How that was not going well. So it was, you know, it's like, you know, this is a good movie about a lot of things, but like, times were fucking heavy, man. I mean, 1974, like, we're just about to be out of Vietnam. Like, Ford is president. Things are hard right now. And I think, like, we've talked about that before, about why were there, you know, sort of better movies then and all that stuff. Like, the people, you know, the audiences had come through World War II, Vietnam. You know, the audiences had lived through a sort of a hard experience in a way that we just haven't. And so we can fantasize about fucking Thanos or whatever in a way that I think seemed silly when you're in the middle of the CIA assassinating people in Watergate and all this bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
Well, CIA is still assassinating people,
that's true.
Right?
That's
we just don't care anymore. I mean, it was like on the fucking, you know, it was in the headlines back then. Yeah. I mean, it was a big deal. And now we're just sort of like,
it's more that we just don't care. Cause like the world is still pretty awful. I think a lot about like the Greg Giraldo, RIP Greg Giraldo bit, where he talks about like reading Civil War letters and like how florid and beautiful the language was and just like how people were learned to a different level back then. And then like letters that people are writing home from the wars on terror that are just like grammatically incorrect and just like full of like stupid racist observations. So every time period has been pretty awful. But yeah, we are in a bleak time. Every time is a bleak time. Can we just decide on that? Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's headlines. Jason, what did the critics have to say about The Godfather Part II?
You know, they were not all as enthusiastic as you might imagine. Leading the way on the negative side was the New York Times' Vincent Canby, who wrote, quote, The only remarkable thing about Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather Part II is the insistent manner in which it recalls how much better his original film was. Among other things, one remembers The Godfather's tremendous narrative drive and the dominating presence of Marlon Brando in the title role, which, though not large, unified the film and transformed a super gangster movie into a unique family chronicle. Part 2, also written by Mr. Coppola and Mario Puzo, is not a sequel in any engaging way. It's not really much of anything that can be easily defined. It is a second movie largely made out of the bits and pieces of Mr. Puzo's novel that didn't fit into the first. It's a Frankenstein's monster stitched together from leftover parts. It talks, it moves, and fits and starts, but has no mind of its own. Occasionally, it repeats a point made in The Godfather. Organized crime is just another kind of American business, say. But its insights are fairly lame at this point. As I alluded earlier, Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars and wrote, The Godfather Part 2 moves both forward and backward in time from the events in The Godfather in an attempt to resolve our feelings about the Corleones. In doing so, it provides for itself a structural weakness from which the film never recovers, but it does something even more disappointing. It reveals a certain simplicity in Coppola's notions of motivation and characterization that wasn't there in the elegant masterpiece of his earlier film. He does praise several elements and performances while concluding, quote, Coppola is unable to draw all this together and make it work on the level of simple, absorbing narrative. The stunning text of The Godfather is replaced in Part 2 with prologues, epilogues, footnotes, and good intentions.
Okay, that's I haven't been through menopause yet, but this has got to be what hot flashes feel like. This
However,
however. Who was in their right mind and who
Charles Champlin at the LA Times wrote.
Okay. Shout out Los Angeles.
The creative aesthetic success of this long enterprise is also, I think, on the heroic scale. Godfather 2 is quieter, less propulsive, less furiously violent than Godfather 1, and it demonstrably lacks the hypnotic patriarchal figure of Brando as Don Corleone. Still, it is compellingly watchable. The new film settles for its own strengths, and they are considerable, to say the least. And here you go, Mike. She's going to come through for you. And Pauline Kael wrote in The New Yorker, the daring of Part 2 is that it enlarges the scope and deepens the meaning of the first film.
Yes,
The Godfather
absolutely.
Was the greatest gangster picture ever made and had metaphorical overtones that took it far beyond the gangster genre. In Part 2, the wider themes are no longer merely implied. The second film shows the consequences of the actions in the first. It's all one movie in two great big pieces, and it comes together in your head while you watch. Coppola might also have a pact with the audience. We're already so engrossed in the Corleones that he can now go on to give us a more interior view of the characters at the same time that he shows their spreading social influence. The completed work is an epic about the seeds of destruction that the immigrants brought to the new land, with Sicilians, WASPs, and Jews separate socially but joined together in crime and political bribery. This is a bicentennial picture that doesn't insult the intelligence. It's an epic vision of the corruption of America. And
oh my God, come on, Pauline.
How?
Thank you.
That's why she's the best.
How did it do, Pauline, in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
Godfather 2 was not as big of a commercial success as Godfather 1, which was the highest grossing movie of 1972 and of all time until the release of Jaws 3 years later. But it earned a very respectable $47 million domestic, showing a handsome profit from the reported $13 million budget.
Oh, nice.
It came in number 6 for the year, behind such less notable efforts as Earthquake, The Trial of Billy Jack, and the year's highest grosser, The Towering Inferno. Which no one was mistaking for the greatest movie ever made before Citizen Kane was decided.
That's true.
To be put in that place.
Absolutely.
But Coppola really cleaned up at the Oscars, where it actually outperformed the original film. And it should have got fucking cinematography too. They repeated the best picture win. It was the first sequel to do so, and best adapted screenplay. But this time Coppola nabbed best director, which went to Bob Fosse back in 72. Robert De Niro won for Best Supporting Actor, one of 3 nominations for this film in that category. The film also won the Oscars for Best Art Direction and Best Original Dramatic Score. It also won the DGA and WGA awards, though it came away empty-handed at the Globes. Bunch of putzes over there. Come on, you can't even give Strasberg a fucking award? This was really his debut? I didn't know this was his debut. I knew he had a thin resume. I didn't know this was his first one.
Yeah, God, I mean, there are many many impressive things. And the thing which we talk about at length in the 74 show, so we won't go back and do it here, but is the fact also that, like, Coppola put out, not only put this out, you know, 2.5 years after Godfather 1, but in between them made the fucking Conversation, like made another whole ass stone cold masterpiece between these two masterpieces. Like, yeah. And then after this, his next movie was Apocalypse Now. Like, who has had a better four film run? I am hard pressed to think of one. All right. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each take a turn and talk about one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with the primary film of today's show. Roxana, you are the guest and you should go first.
Yeah, so this was hard because I think that it's sort of obvious to think of like other organized crime movies, which is fine. Love an organized crime movie. So the way that I thought about this was to think about other figures in American cinema who are like wrongly labeled as only making gangster movies. So I went to Marty, of course. And I did think about Gangs of New York, because I think that is a similar sort of like
epic
immigration, epic scope, immigration storyline. Early days of New York, look at this city and like the flux of change. What do different immigrant groups bring to this country? And just like all of that sort of like transformational stuff, I think would play very well. And I also just think that movie also has this whole like shadow of your father versus like pull of your new country thing that's happening, which I really enjoy. So I feel like this would be like a fun like who's your daddy double feature sort of thing. I think those two could work together well.
Agreed.
How about you, Bailey?
You know what? It was pure chance, but the day that I rewatched was also the day that before awards voting and things happened, I needed to watch The Brutalist. The very recent, currently in theaters, The Brutalist. And I found that they matched quite, they paired quite well. And not only because they are both 3.5 hours, but this, you know, that too is a film about the immigrant experience and about the American dream and about the corruption of power. And it is very much a film about class and the dangers of attempting to rise above one's station. It's also very much, I don't know, it's in a similar way that I can't really pinpoint. It also feels motored by an ambitious filmmaker who is trying to sort of cram all of what movies can do into 3.5 hours. Like I say, it was not a purposeful double feature, but I actually did this double feature and it totally fucking worked. Mike, what is your double feature recommendation?
You guys are way overthinking this. The double feature for Godfather Part 2 is Godfather Part 1, and I think that's pretty fucking obvious, and somebody's got to say it. I realized we were talking about the two of them, and Pauline does as well, as if they're one movie. We're sort of kill billing this thing, but like seriously, come on, watch the fucking first one if you haven't seen the second one, and watch it first for Christ's sakes. Respect the man, watch them in order, and while you're sitting there, order a pie and watch the third one too, because as long as you watch it in sequence, the third one is really great. I like the third one. I don't like all the performances in the third there's one of the major actors in that movie, and it's not the daughter, I don't like literally in anything I don't think I've ever seen him in. And he's very important in that movie. And I don't like him in the movie, but he still doesn't ruin it. I mean, like, I can think of a million counterfactuals for one of the actors in fucking Part 3 and be happy with almost all, but you could damn near put Pauly Shore in that role and I would be happy.
Who are we talking about? Are you slamming Andy Garcia in front of?
Thank you. I don't know why. I don't find him.
Wow.
I do not find him believable in anything I've ever seen him in. And it's obviously my problem. There's obviously, he reminds me of some kid's uncle that I went to elementary school with or something that I don't even remember. Cause everybody else likes him. I'm the only one that doesn't have a problem with him. But even, and this is part of why I genuinely think it is a good movie, is because even with somebody who I really think is bad, who's in a very important role, all of the Michael stuff is incredible. And the only possible way that you could turn that movie, this series up in any way whatsoever, is to literally go to the fucking Vatican banker, is the only way you could grow the movie at all. I mean, you're really like, you're boxed into a corner when the Senate is trying to decide whether or not you're a fucking gangster. Like, you really can't get any higher than that, right? Yeah. But they find the one level you can go higher than that. And I find it really fucking compelling. Like, whatever the fuck I have to say about Garcia, the guy that plays the Vatican banker is incredible. And like, I don't know how you can smoke that many, as many cigarettes as he must have had to smoke to play that role and like come out on the other end of it. Like, that guy, anyway, I think three is good. And so I'm going to say, if you haven't seen two, pair it with the first and the third. You know,
there you
those
go.
Guys knew there what they go. Were doing. It's a good movie.
There it is. Seek out The Godfather Coda, the recut that Coppola did a couple, 3 years ago, because it is, he made some changes that I think really do help with the narrative propulsion of that particular picture. All right. There are your double up recommendations. Roxana, where can people follow you on social media?
You can follow me still on X. I'm also on Blue Sky. I'm on there. I'm on the internet. We'll see.
Any big pieces coming up? Any personal appearances coming up? Anything you'd like to plug?
Is
an acceptable answer.
The only thing that I can think of, it's not upcoming, it happened already, but in terms of like movies about America that feel sort of misunderstood, I did a piece about Observe and Report 15 years later, like post-Obama presidency.
Hell yes.
And sort of in our like new America and how that movie felt like a warning for what was coming. So that ran in December at Vulture, if you wanted to seek that out.
That'll be in the fucking show notes like hell.
Oh, thank you.
I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
Go look at Black Diplomats on YouTube, where we are going to be publishing stories about Black people in Ukraine for Black History Month, leading up to the third anniversary of the big war.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please leave us a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and such, you can do that at, new URL, buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us and the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds.
And last but not least, shout out to a couple of people. For one thing, Danny Perry does know about our show, and we will have a very special guest, Mr. Danny Perry, coming up soon. So for everybody's like, hey, you just stole this guy's shit, we asked him first, and he was on board with it. And I just feel like at some point in the first episode, we need to just say that out loud.
Danny Perry
thinks this is a good idea and likes our stuff.
Yeah. And he will be a guest, and we're just working out the date. We're just trying to get our schedules to match up.
Well, we're just trying not to bug him because, you know, he's Danny Perry. He's the fucking man. Like, we are on his schedule. He is not on ours. Indeed. But I just felt like that needed to be said in the first episode. Yep. Also, shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, the Hyman Roth of our Corleone family, minus betrayal, mostly because he looks great with his shirt off.
Thank you again, Roxana.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.